Look up there in the sky. It's a bird, a plane. It's Handsome Boys Comics Hour.
Those boys are so handsome.
One writer,
one artist,
one weekly discussion of comics and nerd culture. I am your host, Robbie Dorman, literature geek and writer.
And I'm your other host, Eric Z. Goodnight, professional artist and illustration nerd.
And we are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour, your home for news, reviews, slightly antagonistic banter, and much, much more. Eric, how's it going?
It's going all right. It's been a long, exhausting weekend.
I hear you.
So if we're dragging a little bit, we're already making excuses.
I'm ill as well, so I apologize for the quality of my voice. We'll see how well I hold up.
Let me ask you this. Do you have a license for that ill?
I'm completely unlicensed.
You are unlicensed to ill. That's good.
Yeah, exactly. I would think that actually make you a bit more cooler.
It's kind of punk rock.
Then if you are licensed.
Yes, it's like you're illin', like in, you know, like the basement of some meatpacking plant or something, you know.
Sounds pretty hardcore.
Yeah, that's about
anything
as hardcore
that happens
as it
in the
gets.
Basement of a meatpacking.
Did plant. You ever? There's a episode of Bones where they're having like a black metal concert in like the basement of a meatpacking plant. We hadn't talked about that.
I think you've mentioned it to me before.
They completely don't understand what like death metal is, and
that sounds
think
about
that,
right.
That it's not like, I don't know, a huge thing, and people listen to it and then go and have normal lives.
Yeah, where you mean it's the one where Angel and Emily Deschanel don't kiss, like every episode.
That's the one. Yeah. It's also the one that I don't watch.
Yeah, exactly. I watched like 6 episodes of Bones. I'm like, they're all the same. This is the same show. Every episode, I guess they make it way so you can just jump in whenever you want.
That's the nature of episodic television, I think.
To a certain extent. So, folks, this week in Bones Talk.
I hope you enjoyed that.
How dreamy is Angel?
The dreamiest.
I guess that's true.
And the owls are the hootiest.
Shucky ducky quack quack.
Nothing we say makes sense to anyone but us.
Yep. I think it's time, on that note, to go over to our first segment. That is Checking In. Checking In is our show. Eric and I talk about what we've been up to during the week. And we talk about, like, things we like and things we don't like.
I don't like you.
You're checking in with that?
Well, you said dislike things I don't. You think, yes. I'm lying. I really like you.
Aww.
Pass it on.
Is this a telephone game?
Yes.
Should I tell my cat?
You should tell your cat. Oh, my God.
They'll pass it on.
I think we're delayed. That isn't what I said. Oh my God, who said meow? We're delirious, I think. We're very silly today.
So, Eric, what have you been up to this week?
I've been fighting with Linux forever. Oh my God. I was up until three in the morning typing things into a Linux server and getting angry.
It sounds like a great hobby you got there.
It's a wonderful one. But thankfully, I have more or less resolved the problem and have a bunch of new problems to fix.
That's what Linux means, right?
Yes.
I'm not like a hardcore scientist or anything, but Linux means fixing one problem, causing many.
Yes, that's exactly it. There's a really great XKCD where he's like trying to install like OpenBSD on his laptop or something, and by the end, he's like just doing nothing but trying to solve problems. And by the end, his whole house is flooded and there's no description how it happened. So that's what Linux is like. Anyway, I actually have real things to check in with other than all the suffering I invite into my life.
Okay.
With Linux.
What would those be?
I have discovered a podcast, if you're so inclined to listen to one of those.
I listen to podcasts.
My goodness, no one listens to podcasts.
No one.
No, nobody.
Only nerds.
No, there is this podcast. It's a very sort of me podcast. It is interviews with artists and illustrators and comic book personalities. I'm not even sure what you'd call them. And it's hosted by Boing Boing. And it is called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. And I just sort of started listening to it on the recommendation. I started listening to this podcast mostly because of the recommendation of David McRaney, the host of You Are Not So Smart, who's also on the Boing Boing Network. But I'm only a couple episodes deep, but it was really interesting. One of the things that stood out to me was an interview by a pair of artists. One is, he's part of the team that's doing G.I. Joe versus Transformers.
Okay.
It's a strange team up for a comic book. And the other person that was on the podcast is doing a comic called Hip Hop Family Tree. And one of the things that...
Which we talked about that briefly at the comic book store.
Yeah, I think it'd make good fodder for book club, and it's source material. It's something I'm interested in anyway. But they had a lot of very interesting things to say, one of which was he talked about how he's sick of people bashing Todd McFarlane to an extent, but he was mostly talking about our good buddy.
Which one?
Rob Liefeld, okay. Your favorite.
He is my favorite. He shares my name.
He does. It was really unusual. His point of view on it was like, I'm really sick of people bashing Rob Liefeld. The whole point of him as an artist is because it was different, because for some reason it did draw me in as a child. For some reason it brought me into comics. And his work is not about being like academically correct. It's not about having correct anatomy or any of that stuff, which I still completely disagree. But it was interesting to hear the point of view.
Yeah, I think it's that. I mean, it's not the first time I've, you know, there's people I've, you know, they say he's like Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can see their perspective.
And I get that. I don't think he does not work like Jack Kirby did.
No,
he does not. Yeah, he's also made shitloads more money than Jack Kirby did.
It's also true.
So I don't know that I'm exactly shifting my position, but I think that it's going to lead me to, like, I'm probably going to start listening to Rob Liefeld's podcast, and I kind of want to hear what he has to say about things. I think I'm going to be a listener. I don't think they're exactly publishing lots and lots of episodes. Mm-hmm. Their last episode came out right after Heroes Con, which was like middle of the summer, early summer.
June.
Yeah. So that's quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll probably be a while before their next one, but I've enjoyed it tremendously, and there's a small backlog of episodes that I'll have to check all of them out, but yeah, very much looking forward to it.
Cool. I'll listen to it. Check out Rob Liefeld.
Oh yeah.
Episode.
We'll have to look.
Rob Liefeld has a podcast?
Yes. He talks about it on his Twitter.
Okay.
I follow Rob Liefeld and fake Rob Liefeld, which is much funnier.
Yeah.
And has the same avatar, I think.
Well, yeah, they do that.
Yes.
They like to fuck with you.
Yes, it's true, but it's quite hilarious. The other thing I should check in with.
Ooh.
Do you know what this is?
I don't know what this is because I don't know what you're going to say.
You don't know what dapperness I've been up to?
Not directly.
You don't know about Dapper Day Part 2?
I know
two?
About
Part Do.
I don't know about Part Part
Dapper
do.
Day Dart Do.
Part DDB.
Burp bleep.
I don't know. I don't. I was in Philadelphia.
So you were in your test what you're checking in with cheesesteaks?
I was turned off from the world, so no, I don't. Please enlighten me. How was Dapper Day Part D?
Part D. It was damp. It was damper
really?
Day.
Damper
it,
day?
It rained quite a bit, but not as much as I thought was going to. But it's been pouring here quite a lot.
Rained in Florida? Mm-hmm. No, it's crazy.
It rained so much. And
how much did it?
A lot. That's not a good answer.
No.
I don't know. It was Dapper Day. I don't think it was quite as magical as the first day. But, you know, hung out with some fun people and had a good time. Ate cool. Some, tore some crabs apart.
Really?
Yes. Shortly after. I had a rose on my chest. I told people we came from prom. We rode some rides in Disney's Hollywood Studios that'll be closed.
But it was fun. Dapper Day.
It was pretty good. I mean, it's hard to say a lot about it. We didn't spend a whole lot of time there. It rained, and it's the worst park, decidedly.
Yeah, I agree.
Send in your complaints to Robbie at handsomeboyscomics@gmail.com.
Yeah, sure. I'll mic all your complaints about Disney.
All your complaints.
I own Disney.
It's true. Now, I was saying your complaints about us knocking your park.
We were actually getting excited about Dapper Day next year in the spring. Mm-hmm. Dapper Day. But those people we know are getting married on that day on 3/14.
What a bunch of dapper dicks.
I know. Can't go to Dapper Day. We have to be dapper at a wedding.
I know. Oh well. I'm sure they won't listen to this. So yes, good times, dapper days. So,
mm-hmm.
How many cheesesteaks did you eat?
None.
None.
I ate no cheesesteaks in Philadelphia.
They can excommunicate you for that.
We didn't really do much Philadelphia things. We were mostly just hanging out with my family. We did go to like a Manayunk, which is in East Philadelphia. It's a very kind of hipstery downtown area where they have record stores and, you know, breweries and craft breweries and stuff like that. And we got a lunch there, but I'm not checking in with Philadelphia. I am checking in with an old video game. As is my way.
This is 3 for 3. That's a hat trick.
I know. Saints Row 4. I've been playing co-op with my fiance, Kim. It is a lot of fun.
You set her up that time, so.
I know.
I don't have to ask you who it is. She's not a cat or a soda magnate this time.
No, she's not a cat or a soda magnate.
Very clearly your fiance.
Yes. I think most people are familiar with Saints Row 4 in general. It's basically become a parody of GTA.
Yes.
In the most ridiculous way possible. I mean, there's a dubstep gun in this game. You kill people with dubstep.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's why Skrillex went to jail, right?
I did not know he went to jail, but...
Well, yeah, he killed a bunch of people with dubstep.
Okay.
What do you think's going to happen?
I guess that's fair. But it's completely ridiculous open world kind of gameplay. You start the game off by infiltrating a Soviet nuclear missile silo and jumping onto a missile as it is launching, and you disarm it while Aerosmiths Don't Want to Miss a Thing plays.
Yes, that's the part you've already told me about.
Yes, and then you dive off of it, land in the Oval Office as you are now the president.
I mean, I would elect anyone that could do that.
And then aliens. And then aliens attack, and you have to kill the aliens. But they put you in the Matrix, and then you get superpowers. It's completely ridiculous. It doesn't take itself seriously at all. It's hilarious. You get to choose a taunt, and I chose Ric Flair's his little strut. And my celebration is Hacksaw Jim Duggan has the hoe. I have the hoe. I have that as my celebration.
I just blew out the thing there.
But yes, Saints Row 4, it's a completely ridiculous game. Does not take itself seriously. Yeah, that's my main problem with most of the GTA games, is that you have this open world gameplay and you can do whatever you want. Just shoot 1,000 people in the face. But then it also has this, this super serious gameplay. More cat destruction. Super serious story. And it doesn't, but Saints Row 4, they're like, yeah, you can kill people, it's fine. But it's also, yeah, we know it's ridiculous.
I definitely have always wanted a game that tells me and assures me that it's all right to kill people.
Yeah, it's absolutely all right. You can just kill as many as you want. Kill them, you get stuff from them, so that's good.
Well, this is giving me good lessons about life.
You get to do wrestling moves on them too.
Goodness.
Yeah. So Saints Row 4, double thumbs up. It's a lot of fun. It's really fun co-op as well. If anyone's looking for a good co-op game, definitely is that. Other thing I'm checking in with is also a podcast. It's relatively popular, I believe. I don't think I've actually suggested it on air though. So, and I it's called the X-Files.
Not a redundant name at all.
No, with Camille Nanjiani, comedian. He is also on the Indoor Kids podcast on Nerdist Network. He loves the X-Files. He's been a fan for most of his life. And he is basically he's going through first season. He just did half the episodes because he doesn't really think a lot of them are worth, dedicating a lot of time to. But from basically the second season on, he's just doing an episode per, he's doing one or two episodes per podcast. Sometimes he gets, famous people or other comedians on and talk about them with him, other people who really like the X-Files. I've never been a huge X-Files fan, but I was a little too young, I think, to be at my wheelhouse when it was airing. But it's really interesting, and you don't really have to be a hardcore fan to really get anything out of it. It's really interesting hearing him talk about a show that he clearly likes a lot.
I wouldn't have thought that would have been enough to really draw anybody into that. That's not a huge fan of X-Files.
It's very interesting. It was right on, I don't know. I watched it some as a kid. I preferred the kind of the Monster of the Week episodes versus the kind of the mythology episodes, the ones that were about the UFOs and everything. And, hearing kind of the way the show worked, especially how, he goes deeper than just what happens on the show. Talks about kind of the background and the kind of the political climate that kind of allowed the show to blossom and become as popular as it did.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a very good podcast. It always keeps my attention.
Neato.
Neato Torpedo.
It is Neato Mosquito.
So it's X-Files. Check it out.
It's nice, redundant titles.
Yeah. I like it.
Neat.
Yeah. But that's it. That's it from me. I think that's it for checking in. We'll go over from checking in to the floppiest part of the week. You know what part of the week that is, right, Eric?
I assume it's weekly floppies.
You're right! It is time for weekly floppies.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Woohoo. Mm. Weekly floppies is part of the show where Eric and I... part of the show where Eric and I read a selection of the week's books, tell you to buy or do not buy them. We're generally right. Or at least Eric is. I know that's how I think we frame it. That Eric's right and I'm generally right when I agree with him.
I like the sound of, I like the way you think, Dorman.
I know. I'm buying into the good night Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
Drinking it. We're going to start off the week with a comic with a completely ridiculous title. Because I was picking out books for this week, I was like, I can't find anything to read for DC this week. And Kim, the aforementioned Kim, said, you should pick one of these Future Zen books. I'm like, I really don't want to read any of these Future Zen books because they're gimmicky and I hate it. She's like, no, you should do one and talk about it. So I'm like, well, what's the most ridiculous one we could read?
This is clearly it.
Yeah, it's...
Star Spangled War Stories, Future's End, G.I. Zombie.
Number one,
because there's...
There could be so many.
As if this is... It's not going to be 140.
We're going to be like, 20 years. This is a 10-year-old comic, G.I. Yeah. Zombie 275.
What a silly, silly book this is.
Yeah, there is a ongoing title right now that is Star Spangled War Stories G.I. Zombie. But, and by DC edict, they have to have a Future's End tie-in because that's what this month is. It's gimmicky shit month. So they had to do a really... I guess this book is appropriate to do this because you have to know nothing about it to understand what's going on, in that it's completely nonsensical regardless if you've been reading it or not.
Yes, it's silly as shit, regardless of anything.
Yeah, I don't know how to describe the plot. Zombies attacking paratrooper zombies, attacking this...
It reminds me a lot of the wartime, like, sort of the Army He-Man story, you know, something like Wally Wood's canon.
Yeah.
You know, except the main character is like a sentient zombie.
Who can, like, absorb.
Yes. I mean, because, why not? It's dumb as hell.
Yeah, it is dumb. It's very dumb.
It's got Palmiotti writing it.
Yeah.
I think that says a lot about it.
I don't...
And covered by Dave Johnson.
I don't know how I feel about this book.
It's dumb as shit. I kind of think that it doesn't go far enough.
That's probably the thing that's holding me back from endorsing it.
Yes.
Is that there's no reason this book couldn't even been 10 times as crazier.
Yes.
Because it's not connected to Future's End in any way.
Clearly not.
No, there's no... The only... Like, it could do anything. And it's still kind of a... rote story. That I was actually kind of curious about this actual title. The Star-Spangled War Stories G.I. Zombie book. Because it's such a strange thing.
And a touch on the weird side, yes.
Yeah, I just... But I can't... say buy this. This is an excuse for us to say this, that Future's End tie-in stuff is really dumb, especially considering that why every book when obviously this one it didn't need this. I don't know.
Yeah, it clearly has nothing to do with it.
So, but it will probably make more money than it normally would just because it has a stupid holographic cover or some garbage. I didn't read the credits, did I?
Nope.
Justin Gray, Jimmy Palmiotti wrote it. Scott Hampton drew and colored it. And Rob Lay did the letters. But I'm a do not lie.
I don't think you should buy this. This is even... I like a lot of the people that worked on this. Dave Johnson is one of my favorite comic artists. And I don't even like the cover that he did.
It's... kind of, I don't know, forgettable.
It absolutely is. So I say do not buy it either.
Next up, that's, if you guys keep in track, double do not buy.
I was going to say, you didn't eat the microphone and then say double do not buy.
Om nom nom. On to our first indie book of the week. It is Bob's Burgers, number 2. It is written by 6 people, or 5 people, and drawn by 5 people. Or more than that. There's additional artists in multiple places. So I'm not going to read everybody. But there's a lot of them.
that's drawn and written by humans.
Yeah, there's many people that worked on this. This book is basically structured so that every issue has 3 to 4 little mini stories featuring different characters. Like, you know, and they're presented in different ways. The first is Tina's Erotic Friend Fiction presents Battleship Galactina, which is just like a sci-fi parody featuring Tina, and then so on and so forth. There's just miniature little adventures featuring different characters in different ways. Some are parodies, some are direct stories from the actual universe. Some of them just in weird little parody adventures and stuff like that. I know we've talked about this off-air, Bob's Burgers, a little bit.
Briefly, I think. We haven't really gone into too much depth on it.
No, but I like the show, from what I've seen. I haven't seen all of it, but I've seen enough of it to know that I like it.
I want to say that I've watched every episode on...
Netflix?
Every Netflix episode, probably at least twice, now that I think about it. Mm. It's a good show. It's particularly once you get out of the first season. First season is a little on the weaker side.
It improves drastically.
Most shows they get made, they barely make it on the air. They don't quite know what they are. They figure it out pretty quickly, or they don't.
Yeah.
But the thing that I enjoy about Bob's Burgers, the drawing is ugly. the writing is fine, but really the gem of it is the voice actors, who almost all of them are famous for being voice actors. Like, John Benjamin? What's his name that plays Bob?
Yeah, H. John Benjamin.
I can't believe I actually got his name that right, though.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, like Eugene Merman and Kristen Shaw, they are friggin' hilarious.
Yes.
I love Eugene Merman's character. What is the brother's name? Is it just Gene? For some reason, I want to say he's Gene. It's just because the actor's name is Eugene Merman.
No, it is Gene.
Then I could listen to him forever. He is the funniest thing in the world to me. Tina has apparently become, Tumblr.
Yeah, she's like a feminist icon.
Yes.
This is the second issue of the comic book. Do you think the comic book represents the show well enough?
I think it doesn't. I mean, it can't possibly capture the things that I like the best about it,
Voice acting.
Not only the voice acting, but the way that the dialogue is written, because it doesn't feel very, you know, very rote. It doesn't feel very, and maybe I'm using that word incorrectly, but it does not feel highly scripted. In the same way that something like Home Movies was done, that they sort of went Marvel style on the dialogue. They're like, well, say something like this, and they just sort of interact, and then they animate around whatever the voice actors say. And it feels very naturalistic, and it's just funny people being funny, and it's brilliant. But this, I mean, it's okay, it's fine. I am generally unimpressed by it. I think if you're dying for more of the Belcher Kids, it's that. But
yeah.
I think that it doesn't quite have the magic that some comic properties that some have. This is not quite there.
Yeah, it's fun enough. I mean,
I didn't want to kill myself when I was reading it.
No, it's enjoyable, but I think it's really for people who really like Bob's Burgers. If you really like Bob's Burgers, this is the comic for you. It doesn't feel like Adventure Time is the best case scenario, I think, for a licensed comic book.
Also Regular Show.
That's true. Regular Show is also pretty good. It translates very well into the comics.
I think it's better than the show, honestly. are amazing.
I still like the Regular Show.
I enjoy it. It is really grown on me.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence on this one. I guess I'm a do not buy.
Yeah, don't. You don't need
for
to
me,
buy this.
But if you are a fan of Bob's Burgers, like, if you really love it, then you'll probably like this well enough to buy it. You're probably already buying it if you love Bob's Burgers that much, but it looks like the show. The writing is similar to the show, but again, it does not have the excellent delivery of those voice actors to kind of, I think it helps that it's not, like, formulated like the show, that it's just these little mini adventure things, because it's easier to encapsulate kind of a character's voice when you only have to write them for 8 pages.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still, I think we're a sort of a double do not buy, unless you love it.
I'm a do not buy.
Okay.
It's a pale shadow of the things that I like about the show.
Pale shadow.
Mm-hmm.
In the night.
Yes, I dance with the devil in the pale moonlight.
I was not trying to be Jack Nicholson.
Well, you can be whatever you want to be.
I don't think that's
true. If you believe in yourself and don't buy Bob's Burgers, the comic book.
I don't think that'll solve all my problems.
It'll solve wasting $4 on this book.
It was $4, you're right. Next up is Wayward, number 2. Story by Jim Zub. Line art by Steve Cummings. Colors by Jean Roche and Jim Zub. Letters by Marshall Dillon. And back matter, quote unquote, by Zach Davison. We had read the first issue, and I think we had a... Were you a buy or were you do not buy? I know you were on the edge.
I was even going to ask you the same question.
I was a buy. I was a mostly buy. I was like a 7 buy, I'd say, on the scale of from 1 to 10. I think I liked it well enough.
I can't remember.
I want to say you were like a very kind of like, I like the premise, but I didn't like this issue or something, or you thought it was mildly pretentious.
I'm not exactly sure how I felt about it, but I feel like I came into it. I came into it liking it less than I left. You know, after we discussed it, it helped me to see it through your eyes, and I've warmed up to it some. I enjoyed this issue.
Wow.
It's,
okay.
It's growing on me more and more. I think I want to at least stick in here for a first arc and see where this goes and then never read it again.
I think that's pretty interesting because I'm actually a little bit more down on it after this issue.
Interesting. I'm dying to hear why.
I actually listened to an interview with Jim Zub today at work, and they talked about this a lot, mostly in the interview because it's his newest thing. And the cutting. I understand that it's a real thing. It seemed to come out of nowhere for me.
Yes, it is really very tacked on.
And I don't know if you saw this. I did not realize this until I heard the interview. But she actually, what's cut into her arm is the kanji for alone or lonely, one of the two.
Hmm.
And I was, and like hearing that, I'm like, ugh.
It means,
that's,
yeah.
That's does, a little it, much for me.
Well, it does say it right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, what it means, it, alone? It's a,
I didn't
it says, one, well, it says one person.
Okay.
That's Hitori. Means one person.
And I'm
person.
Just, I'm just like, I didn't get that the first time I read it.
Yeah.
And I'm just, it just seems a bit much.
It's a
to
bit
me.
Hot topic, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just like, I know that it's a real problem and that people do it to try to deal with stress and pain, but it just, it just suddenly, she's a little stressed out, she's feeling sick, suddenly pull out the razor blade. I'm just like,
right.
What? Really?
I know it felt very tacked on and very unnecessary.
And
go ahead.
I was going to say, he said, like, the way he was talking about it, he didn't want to make it feel like that. He didn't want to make it gimmicky, but I'm like, I don't know how you introduce it in a comic like this without making it feel gimmicky, like unnecessary, like just kind of strange and out of place. Cause like, I don't know. It left kind of a sour taste in my mouth because it just felt like it. If you're gonna have that in a comic book, you need to have more than a page about it and then nothing. and just, you know, her then encountering a dude who's eating spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't like. I didn't like him either. He's very, so very much. He felt more just kind of corny than what do you call those? The turtle creatures?
They were Kappas, weren't they?
Kappas, yeah, that, I don't know. I felt like they were, I don't know, this guy with the veins in his head and he has black, you know, glowy eyes, and I feel just like he felt out of place to me. More like he's just too standard anime tropey to. I feel like you felt after that first issue. I like the promise of it, but this issue is just kind of, it felt, I liked the first issue because it felt more fun and adventure-y. And then this issue, you know, with the cutting, it just felt very kind of dark and grim, and it felt like it went too dark for kind of the teenage adventure-y feel that I felt in that first issue.
I think if you just ignore that page, which I sort of did, I'm like, okay, that's there. I'm going to just ignore that. Then I don't have the problem with it.
I guess that's true.
I was like, well, that didn't happen. I retconned it as I read it.
I like, well, like, and he says they're going to revisit it later in the series.
Yeah,
and apparently in that first issue, like, you can see glimpses of the scars, like, on her arms.
Mm-hmm.
If you look closely, of course, I did not see it. I do like, and it dawned on me that it's kind of artful that her power is that she can see these red lines, you know, these paths, and mm-hmm. that is exactly what she's, like, cutting into herself. It's also red, like, it's kind of thematically, the imagery is tied together.
Yes.
I'm still a buy. I still like the promise of this. The rest of the issue is fine. It's just that really kind of unsettled it for me.
I'm surprised by all that not only did you say, like, hi, this is dumb, and then you circle back and you're like, well, bye.
Yeah. I think it's
fun. I'm starting to see more of the promise of it, and I am looking forward to reading more.
I would probably say it would be a do not buy if I don't listen to the interview today.
That's very interesting.
Because I heard what he wants to do, and I am very interested in that. So I would say I would continue reading just because of what he said and what he wants to do with the story. He clearly has plans. Jim Zub is also, he said he wants to be the Canadian Charles Soule. He's writing 6 books a month now. I believe that actually good friends, and Jim Zub had texted him or something and said, I have 3 books coming out today. And then Charles Soule, like, sent a message back, I have 4.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So, that's a double buy on Wayward 2. It's a little, a topsy-turvy. Took quite a circuitous path.
It was a journey.
Yeah.
Thank you for going on it with us.
Yes. Next up is a fresh Marvel book. It is Storm number 3, written by Greg Pak, Scott Hepburn with David Baldean on pencils, Scott Hepburn with Jordi Tarragona on inks, and Rachel Rosenberg doing colors, Corey Pettit on letters. We continue to see kind of these one-shot kind of stories in this book. In this one, it is Storm going back to Kenya to deal with a drought, and she meets a familiar face of Forge. They have a kind of tumultuous recent history together. And that's what a lot of this issue is about trust and kind of honesty and
rain dances.
Yeah, that too. Basically, like, you know, they want her to, you know, make it rain, but, you know, she talks about how, you know, her making it rain here could make it not rain somewhere else, and it could be like this, you know, the kind of the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
or the stealing rain effect.
Or the stealing rain effect. But I know you've been very positive on Storm so far. How do you think about this book, Eric?
Take a deep breath. Say something negative. I'm not sure what it is, whether it's the art that's coloring my experience of it, because it is clearly weaker art than the very, very strong art of the last books. I don't know. It feels like a story with no meat to it. It doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. It just feels kind of washed out. I don't know. It's
washed out.
It's underwhelming.
Yeah, I didn't see the need for Forge to be in this story. Like, I haven't followed anything with any of the books that Forge had been in. The Cable book was, for the few issues I read, were pretty awful, so I didn't read that. But he was on the Renegade team that wasn't, I don't know, it was terrible. But it just doesn't seem to go anywhere. Like, I think that you're right. This art is not as good as the first two issues.
I mean, it's undescribably, not undescribably.
It's not bad. It's not the same. And it's, I don't know. Yeah. I think it's just, we happen to agree both aesthetically that we don't like this as much as,
no,
but I think other people would maybe like it more or less. It's hard to say.
I feel that this is certainly much more naive looking. And I think that there is a portion of people that like comics that really like that sort of naive drawing. There are plenty of artists that have made a great living doing that kind of work, and I don't particularly care for them either. we've talked about a lot of them. I mean, I don't know. It's like the faces and the perspective, the characters don't look dimensional. They parts flatten out and eyes sort of float around in the head.
Yeah.
It's naive, and a lot of it's drawn without reference, except it doesn't have the expert cartooning of a lot of my favorite cartoonists. I don't know. I wouldn't call it ideal. It's serviceable. It works.
Yeah.
It's not a style I particularly care for, but it tells the story well enough. But
yeah,
I would not go out of my way to seek books by this artist.
I would say my actual, I mean, the art is not, it's not bad enough to turn me off, certainly. Yes. But the story has there's no real antagonist in this. I think even in the first two issues, there is something Storm is fighting against. And in this, it is the what she's fighting against is drought. It's much more kind of, and, you know, human nature of people not trusting each other and stuff like that. It's not, there's no clear, like, it's not a flesh and blood person.
Well, it lacks a dramatic story arc that the other ones had.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's hard to say. It seems like that's pretty much going to be how this, at least this first arc goes. It seems like it's just going to be one-off stories, and maybe it seems like they are slowly building towards especially that first issue, like that the militia there, and it seems like they were planting seeds for a return to that, you know, the guerrillas or whatever, those mercenaries, whatever they were, to be a bigger role later in this book. But so far it seems like I don't know if this is, I think I'm a do not buy on this particular issue, but I would not say that necessarily on future issues. I'd probably check them out just on the promise of what the first two issues were.
You know, I actually wasn't going to come out as a do not buy on this, but I think you've convinced me. Because it really is, it's forgettable compared to the other two.
Yeah,
but I kind of feel like I owe it to someone to buy it regardless. But if you're gonna pass on any of the Storm comics, this is the one to pass on. It's not amazing.
So that's a split decision. Guys?
No.
Double do not buy? Okay. Do not buy. We say that, but yet we'll probably read Storm number 4 and like it. So.
I will definitely be reading Storm number 4.
So, lastly, in Weekly Floppies, we have our second Marvel book of the week, and it is New Avengers number 24. This is right along in the time jump with the Avengers, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Valerie Sheedy, Color artist by is Frank Martin and David Curio. Letters by Joe Caramagna. This is a lot of this issue is concerning a conversation basically with Namor and Doom, and they kind of Namor kind of we kind of get an idea of what's happening at least with the Cabal in while this in this 8 months that we are kind of missing. We kind of see, you know, Namor has opened this kind of can of worms by, you know, creating this evil team, and now he's upset that he can't control them like he thought he could. What do you think about this, Eric? I know we were kind of meh on the that Avengers issue.
Mm-hmm. This is an asinine question to ask,
mm-hmm.
because it's such a it feels like such a stock question to ask about any big event like this.
Mm-hmm.
If these villains really have this sort of power to group together and mm-hmm. destroy whole worlds of heroes, why is it successful now so Namor can feel guilty about it? It's just so silly. I don't know.
It's
always let's create this scenario where they can just sort of shake the Ester sketch and let people just do, I don't know. It's ridiculous. Go ahead.
I can try and put a little bit of logic on there. It's not gonna. At the end of the day, it's because it helps. That's what the story needs.
Well, no, exactly. It's plot devicey.
But I think there's a little bit there. I think that, you know, at least half the team, or almost roughly half, being Namor himself, Black Swan, and Maximus, are not necessarily full evil. You know, they are only doing this work because they see it as, at the end, you know, ends justify the means.
Right.
So, you could theoretically argue that, you know, that it's because of their help, the rest of the team is being successful. We haven't seen everything about what's going on with the heroes, the Illuminati, the rest of them. We have no idea what's happened. All we know is that they're on the run in 8 months in the timeline.
Correct.
So I have no idea what they're doing right now. Maybe they are. Who knows? I'm kind of wait and see on that. But yeah, you're at this point. You don't really have. There's no reason that. I mean, there is. I'm sure that all these characters are. There is some sort of sense of self-preservation here because they will die if the universe explodes and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there certainly is that to it. There's a reason that they're doing this because they Hickman at least has set that up that if they don't stop this from happening every time, everything dies. So there's that, but I don't know. Cause it helps the story. I think this is certainly more cohesive than that Avengers story was.
It is, and I enjoy it for that, and I like the sort of the drama of Namor being tortured. You know, he blew up the other Earth and didn't even bat an eye, and now he's getting all squishy on. He feels a little funny about what he's doing, and it's kind of interesting to watch him twist about that. And, you know, so Doom's enjoying making him squirm, you know, in a very Dr. Doom sort of way. It's interesting, and it's a really beautiful book. I really love the drawing of this book.
Yeah, it looks very nice.
I'm a fan. I'm not overwhelmed by this book. I'm not blown away, but I enjoy it. It's possibly the book that I've enjoyed the most this week, but I feel like it's been a somewhat underwhelming week of comics, but this is the most whelming one.
Yeah, I agree with you. I am a buy on it, and I would say that this meets a certain, like, if all these 8 months later kind of stories were of this quality, I would wholeheartedly buy into the event as a whole. Like, this is, it knows where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that Avengers book, I was like, I didn't know if, like, it seemed kind of messy and not necessarily cohesive in a way that all of this is working towards one end and seems like it knows where it's going. And in an event like this, where it's, you know, this weird timeline jump, it's where it's very easy to kind of be messy and lose track of things. Like, at least this is, you know, it tells the story. I know exactly what's happening. And it does have it very nice art, and it's well written, and, you know, has all the hallmarks of New Avengers. Has always been my favorite of the Hickman Avengers books, because we've been reading it most. It's usually the book we read of all these Avengers books that Hickman writes, and I'm certainly a buy on this one. If they're all up to this quality, I'd buy every book in the event.
Delightful.
Does that make you a buy, Eric?
Of course.
That's a double buy. New Avengers number 24. So with that, we're done with Weekly Floppies. We are going to jump over to our last segment of the week, Nerd Boy Book Club. Yeah. There you go. This is the segment where Eric and I assign a longer collective work and kind of discuss it like, you know, you would in a book club. Hence the title.
It's a very clever name when you think
about
it.
Yeah, I know. We're super smart people. This week we are doing Snowpiercer, Volumes 1 and 2. The recent film with Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton is based on these... I think it's kind of an amalgamation of the two, I think, honestly. But,
what are you on? What are you talking about?
The movie.
Yes.
I don't... It's not just one or... It's kind of a... It's adapted from both of these stories. I think it's kind of
yes. Yeah, I sort of figured. I have not seen it, but it seemed like it would be. They would take elements of both.
Yes,
I felt pretty confident about that.
Yeah, I've read the plot synopsis of the movie, and it, from what I can tell, it seems like it's kind of a mixture to make the best Hollywood thing, the thing that people would actually want to watch. I guess we could start with the first volume. This is very interesting to me because I did not realize this when we kind of just picked it out of blue. That it has the same artist with both, and there was a great time difference. The first volume was published in 1982. 82. The second one was in 1999-2000.
Hmm.
And they share the same artist. They have different writers because the writer of the first volume had passed. After finishing the first volume at some point. It is French.
It is incredibly French.
And
not just French, but incredibly so.
Yeah, did you know that going into it? Is that a part of the reason you wanted to? I know you were the one who suggested it at first. I was also interested, but I did not. Did you know it was French before you had suggested it?
I want to say that I did not, but it seems like I had probably heard it at some point, you know, inspired by the French graphic novel.
Right.
It is, that being said, like, I mean, it is incredibly French. And I am beginning to notice, like, I had just, talking about this, it brought up a conversation about Proust.
Right.
About how his book, what is it, In Search of Lost Time, that was the book that we were discussing. After football on Sunday, as you do, you often watch football and then discuss Proust.
That's what happens. It naturally leads to Proust.
It naturally leads to
Proust. Sense memories about tea. That's what I think about after I watch some football.
No, but I was talking about how, I mean, that's just the French way, is to have books full of unlikable characters and stories that sort of barely go anywhere. And I think that describes every Humanoids book we've read for Book Club, almost every Mobius book we've read, or certainly that I've read, and now Snowpiercer is sort of the same way. It's a very French style of writing. I mean, who gives a fuck that the characters are characters? They're not here to be liked by you, and I just think that's very interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, the plot of the first one, the first volume, and they're loosely connected, the first. Yes. And yeah, I think there's actually three volumes because the second book is divided in half loosely. Yes. But it's only grouped into two books. The first one is the very basic premise is that the world is, I guess, nuclear winter, I guess, yes. is what has happened. And there's the only people left alive on Earth are on this train that is circling the globe. And it's divided up by class, that, you know, the richer you are, the closer to the front of the train you are. The poor people are at the back, rich people are at the front, and obviously rich people in the front have it a lot better, and they're segregated, and there's no, you can't just move between trains, and there's certain trains that are, like, filled with meat. the meat tubs, mm-hmm. I guess.
They have a machine that synthesizes meat.
It's like a living
yes.
tub of meat that they just chop off that regrows faster than you can chop it off, apparently.
Yes. It's fairly horrifying.
But the impetus of the story is that a guy from the back managed to kind of sneak his way around the, I guess they have basically locked multiple doors in between the poor section and the middle class and up section.
Mm-hmm.
And he's found a way on the outside of the train to break in. And then we see him quickly find himself a lady who is soon basically just treated just like him because she's like a civil rights activist for the train. She wants the poor people to have rights,
mm-hmm.
and for them to be mixed. And I guess that if there is a theme to this, especially the first story, and certainly the second one as well, is kind of the, I guess, a statement on, you know, classism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, if there's any kind of overarching metaphor, that's what it is. Although, I think the bigger message is, people are terrible.
people are terrible. They're all unlikable. And the story doesn't go anywhere.
I would say that this does have more of a kind of a direction, at least because they are moving through the train.
Mm-hmm.
And something happens when they get to the front. It's not a huge revelation, but it's something.
Yes.
Yeah. The train is also apparently imperceptibly slowing down, which obviously if they stop, they will die.
Yeah, so the whole
it's too cold.
Well, yes, they're generating heat by moving. It's a real oddball. Do you want to set up any of the characters? Do you want to talk about one male lead versus the other male lead?
Yeah, the male lead, like the male lead is the poor guy that mm-hmm. breaks in. He becomes our quote unquote protagonist, even though he's not necessarily a good person himself.
He's not necessarily a terrible person.
No,
but
he's better than most of the other people.
Mm.
I think that's what I got from it. But basically, most of the story is this woman who's lumped in with him when she tries to, you know, basically find out why he's been imprisoned, you know, held by the military presence on the train, and they are kind of being escorted to the front of the train where the leadership is. Adeline is the name of the female, the lady. Proloff.
Proloff.
His name is Proloff. Proloff and Adeline.
It's a friggin' terrible name.
Yeah, but they're called to meet Colonel Crimson. Also a terrible name. But most of it is just kind of our experiencing the different levels of the train as they move through it. You know, they have this rather kind of 3 or 4 man military escort, and some of them are killed, some of them distracted by like prostitutes on the train, and like they go to great lengths to kind of show the decadence that the front of the train experiences when the back of the train is kind of just forgotten about and left to its own devices when it's, you know, it's like a cattle car. But they soon find out after they talk to Colonel Crimson, the K, that they intend to disconnect the rear cars after the civil rights people are on it. And in that, they try and move forward through the front of the train. All the while, apparently there's this virus that is kind of taking over certain parts of the train. Thought to be introduced by Krolov himself, even though he's not showing any ill effects. What do you think of the art?
I think he's very talented and very, very French. The first book in particular, I mean, it looks so much like, it's like Blueberry almost, or it's like some of the more cartoony stuff that not the most cartoony stuff that Mobius would do, but you know, sort of midway, but it's got that sort of French ugliness to it and then the same kind of line work going on. Book two, I mean, I enjoy. I mean, he's a very, very talented artist. But
it's different.
It is. It's too dark, and the ink washes. I think his line work, it was better when it was simpler. You know, it was nice, clean line work, and nice brush work, and heavy shadows, and you got some nice zip tone in there, and that's about it. You know, it was nice and clean, and it read really well, and it was easy on the eye. The ink washes of book two are actually kind of challenging to read. You have to spend more time on each panel to figure out what's going on. I think a lot of it, at least in my copy, is the reproduction. Everything is too dark.
I got the two hardcovers.
That's what I have as well.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, I want to say that my copies are printed inconsistently from page to page.
Really?
That the printing job looks bad. That there are some pages where the darkest areas are like a rich, glossy black, and other pages are like kind of a gray. And the midtones in those are more readable. The art's more readable, but the black is not rich black, which means which shows me that there's a little bit of a hack job in the printing done somewhere at some level, whether the art was not prepped correctly or the pressman was sloppy. And I don't know that it should really have been shipped this way. It's a little bit flawed. I don't know whom to blame on that, or whether maybe, I mean, it's possible that it's even intentional, but it does not seem correct to me.
I
have no way of showing you because.
Yeah, I understand. I agree with you that it is harder to read. And it seems almost more like it's drawn like it's almost like it's in a dream state. Like it's blurry to me. That's what it made me feel, at least.
The first
story is much more like clear, like the lines. And this seems like it's more fuzzy. If that makes sense.
I know for a fact, most Mobius comics, they have that sort of dreamy sort of feel to them. Usually it's based in the writing that characters just sort of make strange arbitrary decisions based in dream logic. But it's interesting that the art comes off with that sort of dreamy feel to you.
It's not all of it, but some of it certainly.
No, I get that.
But I actually think that the writing is tighter in the second story than it was in that first story.
I think I agree. There's, of course, there's also less work to be done of setting up the world, and the first book feels more just of a straight allegory is the correct word.
Correct.
Yes. It's just straight allegory. The second one feels more like an actual story.
Yes.
Like, here's this world. We're telling a story in that world. The first one is borderlining on a morality tale that, you know, that we're society and we're all on the same track together. And if we don't stop, we're going to die. And class structure and you should vote and recycle.
Yeah. The second story is, we say second book. It's actually the second and third volume.
Yes.
I guess you want to say. And it is 30 pages longer, give or take. So it has a little bit more room to explore the how the train works and there's more people with names in the second story. There's multiple leaders of, there's like a military guy, there's a religion guy, and then there's the kind of the diplomat guy that is like a bad guy at first, then becomes a kind of a good guy at the end, and then there's our protagonist and the female protagonist, and they all kind of, there's more, it's more fleshed out. The second book is loosely connected to the first book. It's set in the same world. It's another train that makes these stops, and people are told it's to dodge the Snowpiercer, the train from the first book. And it kind of builds up the kind of the dystopic kind of dictatorship kind of government that you see in, you know, lots of fiction. 1984 is the one that pops first to mind, but anything
it's the classic example.
Yeah, anything like that, you know, the kind of, you know, heavy censorship and control and kind of they kind of have these virtual headsets that kind of are like basically used to as an opiate for the masses, as people, to get people, you know, kind of distracted. You know, you can virtually go on an adventure and they have lotteries to win these trips. And I think it has a lot of the same themes as the first book. It's just a little bit more fleshed out and therefore, and it feels more real. The writing is certainly tighter. You explore kind of how the world works a little bit more than you do in that first book, where it basically is just, you're just on the train. You're just moving back and forth. You know, the bad guys are bad guys. The good guys are good guys, or the less bad guys, if you want to call them that.
They're the unlikable protagonists.
I guess the endings of both these books are, because they're very similar to each other. I don't know. I imagine that they ended the second story much like the first because of that ending of the first story. They wanted to, I guess, not buck the trend too much. The endings of both of these are kind of dreary and depressing, and, you know, kind of both saying the same thing. We're all dead. That humanity is dying and we're going to die. I think it's even worse in the second story. Like the kind of that impact.
You're going to die, Robbie.
I am going to die, but certainly dreary, depressing way that the first story ends. I certainly hope not. The first story ends with them reaching the front car, finding out that there is a guy. The lady is just freezes to death for seemingly no reason. That is the worst, and I think that was really upset me. In that, you know, here you go, dead lady.
Well, how else is she going to become the woman in the freezer?
Literally. She's awful. He shoots out windows and then she freezes to death. Just so dumb. And it's really completely arbitrary. Like why she dies and he doesn't. If she was the one who lived and he had died, I would immediately love this book.
Does that mean you hate men?
Yep, misandry.
Hashtag misandry.
Yep, not all men. But it doesn't do. I mean, it's written 1982. I guess I can't expect it to be too progressive. It's French, though. I would expect it to do something. But, you know, the fact that if, like, they had switched the, flipped the switch a little bit where you're led to believe that, you know, he's the hero, but then she's the one who ends up actually, like,
no, I think,
being
I think,
the last survivor. I think that would have been a lot better.
I would have definitely liked that ending more. Cause he's, I don't know, she's a little bit more likable because she has the redeeming quality of being this activist, or at least having some sort of empathy for people.
Yes, he does not give a shit about anyone.
No, he doesn't. There's nothing redeeming about him at all, really. He's not that interesting a character.
No, the only interesting thing about him is that, oh, look, he survived. Apparently everyone else in the back is dead. So cutting the train cars, who cares if everyone's already dead? Why does it matter? And then, you know, she, like you said, she's the only, she actually has empathy. Like, everyone else in the whole train apparently is just a monster who does not care about anything but, like, their next fix of whatever thing gets them through life, apparently, in this dismal hellhole. I think the second book does a better job at creating at least more likable heroes or protagonists.
The world just in general is much more interesting. I don't know that it is more likable because I don't particularly want to, like, exist in it. Like,
no,
it's not
the world,
it's not particularly
the world's
pleasure.
Not happy. No.
It's, well, not even that it's happy, but it's not, like, it's not pleasant to be in it.
No, it's not.
These books are not pleasant reads. it's true.
No,
it's
I agree.
Absolutely true.
No,
like,
it's...
I avoided reading book two, even though, I mean, I think I agree with you. It's definitely the better story. It's definitely better written. I think I'm probably going to spend more time with book one just simply because I like the art better.
Right. And I think that's kind of a tragedy, is that the writing is better in the second book, but the art is definitely better in the first one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's not bad. It doesn't hold up well to print. I think it could be a lot cleaner if everything was much lighter and printed better.
And, but the character's name in the second book, it's P-U-I-G. I don't know how to say that.
It's Puig.
Puig?
I don't know. That's what I was hearing in my head.
I always like just calling him Pug because it's funnier.
Either one's really goofy.
Yeah, exactly. He has a goofy name, but he's actually shown to be somewhat heroic and to have empathy. He does care about the people on the train. Like, he's going to extreme lengths to try and save the people on the train, even though most of them don't necessarily are worth saving. He's married to the daughter of one of the diplomat of the leaders, I guess, like the political figure, the politician.
I don't know, what do you ever call him? The dictator of the train.
Yeah, there's the politician, the military guy, and the religious guy. Like, they're the three kind of heads of state.
They're the cabal.
Yeah, and he is even given a small arc, kind of the politician guy, the dictator guy, where he's kind of becomes a martyr at the end. You know, he sacrifices himself for the cause. But at the end of the day, they go through. And what? How the hell do they drive a train off the tracks?
About that as well. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Trains do not work like that. Like, it doesn't matter what you do to a train. It doesn't have a steering wheel all of a sudden.
Yeah, they're like, turn the train. How?
How do you do that without the track? We're going to take it off the track. It'll be fine. It just goes slower. No, it doesn't. It's not a car. It doesn't have axles that move.
You can totally drive a train on the ocean.
Okay.
Totally.
Because that is what happens. They drive the train on the frozen ocean and it works, apparently.
I mean, naturally.
And by the end of the story, they're seeking out a radio signal. They hear songs. And the songs are changing, so they think, oh, well, that means that someone is at the control. Someone else is alive. And I believe that they're going to die eventually anyway if they stay on the track they're on. because they don't have enough food to eat, feed everyone.
I don't know that we should necessarily give away the reveal.
Okay.
But at the same time, it's a really stupid ending.
Yeah, it's kind of the most boring of
yes.
what could happen.
It's. I mean, in terms of endings, I think it's maybe one rung down, you know, maybe one rung better than it was all a dream.
Yeah.
That's about, do you know the original ending to Clerks?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
That's what this is. This is exactly like the original ending to Clerks. The original ending to Clerks, if for anyone who has not seen it, is where Dante gets shot. And it was supposed to be this big ironic statement. Oh, I'm not even supposed to be here today.
And then he gets killed.
And then he gets killed. What kind of fucking, like freshman in art school shit is that? That's ridiculous. That is a terrible ending.
Thankfully, they did not go. Kevin Smith was wise enough to not go with that awful, awful ending.
Someone told him to not do it.
And this book, they end similarly. And they both end in a kind of way that's like, kind of like, that's it?
Yes.
Like, in the second book, like we said, like, the story is a little bit more fleshed out. And so I was kind of invested in that. I was really interested to see what was going to happen. And then it kind of does the T.S. Eliot ends with a bang, not with a bang, but with a whimper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of, puffs out nothing and then it ends. I'm just like, we can't get anything.
Yeah.
It just seems kind of like, I don't really know how, I imagine that there was some kind of demand. I don't know how well that first book is, like how it's received in France. I know that they weren't translated until very recently into English. I don't know how that first story is received in France, like if there was a call for the second story, like they didn't want it to depart too far from that first story. Like, I don't know if there was some kind of fear in that, or if it's just kind of this dreary place that didn't want it to make kind of the happy quote-unquote ending. But I think you agree with that it's not necessarily that it's not happy, that it's just boring.
It is boring. I kind of feel like maybe if they had took it just a little bit further, they went to that moment and then showed some horrible fallout from that rather than just being like, oh no, terrible.
And then like six lines of narration.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Like, I think it would have been a much better ending to see terrible tragedy come of events by, you know, bad decisions that were made. And all the, you know, I think that would have been a much more interesting ending, or at least to see the consequence of it, rather than just sort of, I'm sad now. It's, you know, it's weak.
The film itself, this is a spoiler if you haven't seen the film, so jump ahead, I guess. It does go with a hopeful ending. Hmm. Not necessarily a happy one, but a hopeful.
That doesn't surprise me. I don't think I'm bothered by that, because I think these books are too goddamn French for us.
I don't say I regret reading them.
I'm glad to have read them, and I'm glad to own them even.
Yeah, they look, I mean, the hardcovers are nice.
Yes.
And the art, especially in that first volume, is very nice.
It's gonna go really nicely on my shelf of French shit.
Hell, I'm starting my own. I got my own French shit collection starting just from all the stuff we've read on the podcast.
I've been a good influence on you.
I think it certainly caters to that kind of French, I guess, aesthetic, if yes. you want to call it that.
It really does. Like, it, I'm seeing too many of the same ideas and motifs and, I don't know, there, just sort of tone.
Yeah, you know? I think it can be, like, there are, probably over a dozen gross bearded soldiers between the two volumes who are just, like, gross dudes. Kind of guys. I'm just like, I don't need another one. Like, you just keep running into them. I'm like, I get it. I got it. Thank you. Dudes are gross.
Well, let me get some time with that prisoner.
God. Once, I understand. Twice, okay. Three, four, five times. I got it. Women are objects in this world. Thank you. Man, I really wish that dude in the first book had died and the chick had lived.
It really, and it never even occurred to me as I was reading it, but that is, I think we need to make our own Snowpiercer with blackjack and hookers.
Forget about the Snowpiercer.
Yeah. screw the whole thing. Yeah. It's as French as a mime with a baguette.
Yeah, it is more cohesive than the sacred Mad Woman of the Sacred Heart. Mm-hmm. I would put it on par with the cohesiveness of the Meta Barons.
Where I think it's considerably more so.
Really? Well,
You could say a lot of things about the meta, but this is both, I would say both of these hang together much better as a narrative. I mean, the Meta Barons, I love it, but it is squishy as hell.
But I never went, like, I understood the logic in it. I don't, like, in Mad Woman of the Sacred Heart,
I don't think you did not pronounce your air quotes, logic.
Yeah, well, I understood the Meta Barons' logic of, like, yes. Let's get a son and then chop his leg off.
Yeah.
Like, I understood that.
Let's find this guy's head and he'll let me be a poet warrior.
Yeah. Like, in that crazy world, it made sense in a certain weird way.
Yeah. But somehow it worked.
And this is more of a quote unquote story, even though, like, it did not. Especially that first one did not read like I imagined it would, but you know, I was picturing, I should have known. I knew it was French. I should have known before I jumped in that it was not going to be like kind of a weird Die Hard on a train story.
Yes.
I was expecting much too much like actual action, not just a guy walking back and forth on a train, you know, yelling at people.
Yeah.
I would you recommend this? I think we can kind of bookend it on that. Would you recommend this to anyone?
Well, I know a lot of nerds that read French shit, so yes.
But it would not be the first thing you recommend to an average comics reader.
No, clearly not.
No, I would, yeah. You'd have to be heavily couched in. Do you like this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many artists I would recommend it to.
Right. Because
I think it is very artfully drawn. Rachette's artwork is truly excellent, particularly the older book.
Right.
It's really nice.
Do you think any of that, I mean, there's a 18-year gap in time there.
Mm.
I imagine some of it is just him changing as an artist as well as the.
Yeah, I mean, he starts off, he's very Mobius. It reminds me so much of Blueberry. Was clearly a huge influence on him. And the second book looks like Jimenez. It looks like the artist that did the Meta Barons.
I think we can end it on that. So, is it good enough?
I think so. It's good enough to me.
I am curious to see the film. I'm gonna sit down and watch it one of these days. It's on available on video on demand, I believe. Next week, I think we've already agreed that we are reading the next Battling Boy story.
The rise
of Aurora West.
Yeah, correct.
It comes out tomorrow as of time of this recording. I think
My ship is already shipped.
By the time you hear this, it will be out. It's Paul Pope. It's more Battling Boy story. It's going to focus more on Aurora West. And I could not be more excited to read it. It is available on Amazon for like $6. Go buy it somewhere.
The cheapest of the cheapies.
God, and it's actually, I looked at the page length. It's for $6. I can't think you could get a better deal for quality comics. So next week, Rise of Aurora West, Volume 1. Huh, Paul Pope. Great.
Mm-hmm. He's the Pope of my religion.
Until then, I think we'll call it a day. We are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour. You can find us at handsomeboyscomicshour.com. Find us on iTunes, on Stitcher. If you like us, please leave us good reviews there. Rate us. Subscribe. It really helps us out. Gets us more listeners. We are also on Facebook. Facebook.com/handsomeboyscomicshour. You can like us there. Get us in your feed. We're on Twitter at HBCHour. You email us. I believe Eric has already mentioned. You email us at handsomeboyscomics@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter. See all the things I dabble in on the internet at Mixmaster Serial. It's MixMasterCereal on the Twitter machine. Eric, where can I find you online?
Why, that's such a good question. You can see my portfolio by going to freewillunlimited.com, and you can see most of the things I get up to by going to ericzgoodnight.com, and you can tweet at me. Twitter handle is Mr. Bad Example, spelled M-R Bad Example.
So until next time, Heads Mites, have a good one.
Rock and roll. Bap 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 b